The morning is wearing away. We must call for him. At that moment, Boromir reappeared. He came out from the trees and walked towards them without speaking. His face looked grim and sad. He paused, as if counting those that were present, and then sat down aloof, with his eyes on the ground. "Where have you been, Boromir?" asked Aragorn. "Have you seen Frodo?" Boromir hesitated for a second. "Yes and no," he answered slowly. "Yes, I found him some way up the hill, and I spoke to him. I urged him to come to Minas Tirith and not to go east. I grew angry, and he left me. He vanished. I've never seen such a thing happen before, though I have heard of it in tales. He must have put the ring on. I could not find him again. I thought he would return to you." "Is that all you have to say?" said Aragorn, looking hard and not too kindly at Boromir. "Yes," he answered. "I will say no more yet." "That is bad," cried Sam, jumping up. "I don't know what this man has been up to. Why should Mr. Frodo put the thing on? He didn't ought to have. And if he has, goodness knows what may have happened."
"But he wouldn't keep it on," said Merry. "Not when he had escaped the unwelcome visitor, like Bilbo used to."
"But where did he go? Where is he?" cried Pippin. "He's been away ages now."
"How long is it since you saw Frodo last, Boromir?" asked Aragorn. "Half an hour, maybe," he answered. "Or it might be an hour. I've wandered for some time since. I don't know. He put his head in his hands and sat as if bowed with grief.
"An hour since he vanished?" shouted Sam. "We must try and find him at once. Come on."
"Wait a moment," cried Aragorn. "We must divide up into pairs and arrange. Here, hold on, wait." It was no good. They took no notice of him. Sam had dashed off first. Merry and Pippin had followed, and they were already disappearing westward into the trees by the shore, shouting, "Frodo! Frodo!" in their clear, high hobbit voices. Legolas and Gimli were running. A sudden panic or madness seemed to have fallen on the company.
"We shall all be scattered and lost," groaned Aragorn. "Boromir, I do not know what part you have played in this mischief, but help now. Go after those two young hobbits and guard them at the least. Even if you cannot find Frodo, come back to this spot if you find him, or any traces of him. I shall return soon."
Aragorn sprang swiftly away and went in pursuit of Sam. Just as he reached the little lawn among the rowans, he overtook him, toiling uphill, panting and calling, "Frodo!" "Come with me, Sam," he said. "None of us should be alone. There is mischief about, I feel it. I'm going to the top, to the seat of Arm on Hen, to see what may be seen."
"And look, it is as my heart guessed. Frodo went this way. Follow me, and keep your eyes open."
He sped up the path. Sam did his best, but he could not keep up with Strider the Ranger, and soon fell behind. He'd not gone far before Aragorn was out of sight ahead. Sam stopped and puffed. Suddenly he clapped his hand to his head.
"Whoa, Sam Gamgee," he said aloud. "Your legs are too short, so use your head. Let me see now. Boromir isn't lying. That's not his way. But he hasn't told us everything. Something scared Mr. Frodo badly. He screwed himself up to the point sudden. He made up his mind at last to go. Where to? Off east? Not without Sam."
"Yes, without even his Sam. That's hard, cruel hard." Sam passed his hand over his eyes, brushing away the tears.
"Steady, Gamgee," he said. "Think if you can. He can't fly across rivers, and he can't jump waterfalls. He's got no gear, so he's got to get back to the boats. Back to the boats. Back to the boat, Sam, like lightning."
Sam turned and bolted back down the path. He fell and cut his knees. Up he got and ran on. He came to the edge of the lawn of Parth Garlin by the shore, where the boats were drawn up out of the water. No one was there. There seemed to be cries in the woods behind, but he did not heed them. He stood gazing for a moment, stock still, gaping.
A boat was sliding down the bank all by itself. With a shout, Sam raced across the grass. The boat slipped into the water.
"Coming, Mr. Frodo! Coming!" called Sam, and flung himself from the bank, clutching at the departing boat.
He missed it by a yard. With a cry and a splash, he fell face downward into the deep, swift water. Gurgling, he went under, and the river closed over his curly head. An exclamation of dismay came from the empty boat. A paddle swirled, and the boat put about. Frodo was just in time to grasp Sam by the hair as he came up, bubbling and struggling. Fear was staring in his round, brown eyes.
"Up you come, Sam, my lad," said Frodo. "Now take my hand."
"Save me, Mr. Frodo," gasped Sam. "I'm drowned. I can't see your hand."
"Here it is. Don't pinch, lad. I won't let you go. Tread water and don't flounder, or you'll upset the boat. There now, get hold of the side and let me use the paddle."
With a few strokes, Frodo brought the boat back to the bank, and Sam was able to scramble out, wet as a water rat. Frodo took off the ring and stepped ashore again.
"Of all the confounded nuisances, you are the worst, Sam," he said.
"Oh, Mr. Frodo, that's hard," said Sam, shivering. "That's hard, trying to go without me and all. If I hadn't guessed right, where would you be now?"
"Safely on my way."
"Safely," said Sam. "All alone and without me to help you? I couldn't have borne it. It'd have been the death of me."
"It would be the death of you to come with me, Sam," said Frodo, "and I could not have borne that."
"Not as certain as being left behind," said Sam,
"but I am going to Mordor."
"I know that well enough, Mr. Frodo. Of course you are, and I'm coming with you."
"Now, Sam," said Frodo, "don't hinder me. The others will be coming back at any minute. If they catch me here, I shall have to argue and explain, and I shall never have the heart or the chance to get off. But I must go at once. It's the only way."
"Of course it is," answered Sam. "But not alone. I'm coming too, or neither of us isn't going. I'll knock holes in all the boats first."
Frodo actually laughed. A sudden warmth and gladness touched his heart.
"Leave one," he said. "We'll need it. But you can't come like this without your gear or food or anything."
"Just hold on a moment, and I'll get my stuff," cried Sam eagerly. "It's all ready. I thought we should be off today."
He rushed to the camping place, fished out his pack from the pile where Frodo had laid it when he emptied the boat of his companion's goods, grabbed a spare blanket and some extra packages of food, and ran back.
"So all my plan is spoilt," said Frodo. "It's no good trying to escape you. But I'm glad, Sam. I can't tell you how glad. Come along. It's plain that we were meant to go together. We will go, and may the others find a safe road. Strider will look after them. I don't suppose we shall see them again."
"Yet we may, Mr. Frodo. We may," said Sam.
So Frodo and Sam set off on the last stage of the quest together. Frodo paddled away from the shore, and the river bore them swiftly away, down the western arm, and past the frowning cliffs of Tol Brandir. The roar of the great falls drew nearer. Even with such help as Sam could give, it was hard work to pass across the current at the southward end of the island and drive the boat eastward towards the far shore. At length they came to land again upon the southern slopes of Arman Chlor. There they found a shelving shore, and they drew the boat out, high above the water, and hid it as well as they could behind a great boulder.
Then, shouldering their burdens, they set off, seeking a path that would bring them over the grey hills of the Emyn Wheel and down into the Land of Shadow.
The End. You've been listening to The Fellowship of the Ring, the first book in The Lord of the Rings, by J.R.R. Tolkien, narrated by Robert Inglis. The author has written a foreword that talks about the origin of The Lord of the Rings. We include that foreword here.
This tale grew in the telling, until it became a history of the Great War of the Ring and included many glimpses of the yet more ancient history that preceded it. It was begun soon after The Hobbit was written, and before its publication in 1937. But I did not go on with this sequel, for I wished first to complete and set in order the mythology and legends of the Elder Days, which had then been taking shape for some years. I desired to do this for my own satisfaction, and I had little hope that other people would be interested in this work, especially since it was primarily linguistic in inspiration, and was begun in order to provide the necessary background of history for Elvish tongues. When those whose advice and opinion I sought corrected little hope to no hope, I went back to the sequel, encouraged by requests from readers for more information concerning hobbits and their adventures. But the story was drawn irresistibly towards the older world, and became an account, as it were, of its end and passing away before its beginning and middle had been told. The process had begun in the writing of The Hobbit, in which there were already some references to the older matter. Elrond, Gondolin, the High Elves, and the Orcs, as well as glimpses that had arisen unbidden of things higher or deeper or darker than its surface. Durin, Moria, Gandalf, the Necromancer, the Ring. The discovery of the significance of these glimpses and of their relation to the ancient histories revealed the Third Age and its culmination in the War of the Ring. Those who had asked for more information about hobbits eventually got it, but they had to wait a long time, for the composition of The Lord of the Rings went on at intervals during the years 1936 to 1949, a period in which I had many duties that I did not neglect, and many other interests as a learner and a teacher that often absorbed me. The delay was, of course, also increased by the outbreak of war in 1939, by the end of which year the tale had not yet reached the end of Book One. In spite of the darkness of the next 5 years, I found that the story could not now be wholly abandoned, and I plodded on, mostly by night, till I stood by Balin's tomb in Moria. There I halted for a long while. It was almost a year later when I went on, and so came to Lothlorien and the Great River late in 1941. In the next year, I wrote the first drafts of the matter that now stands as Book Three, and the beginnings of Chapters 1 and 3 of Book 5. And there, as the beacons flared in Anorion and Theoden came to Harrowdale, I stopped. Foresight had failed, and there was no time for thought. It was during 1944 that, leaving the loose ends and perplexities of a war which it was my task to conduct, or at least to report, I forced myself to tackle the journey of Frodo to Mordor. These chapters, eventually to become Book Four, were written and sent out as a serial to my son, Christopher, then in South Africa with the RAF. Nonetheless, it took another 5 years before the tale was brought to its present end. In that time I changed my house, my chair, and my college, and the days, though less dark, were no less laborious. Then, when the end had at last been reached, the whole story had to be revised, and indeed largely rewritten backwards. And it had to be typed and retyped by me. The cost of professional typing by the ten-fingered was beyond my means. The Lord of the Rings has been read by many people since it finally appeared in print, and I should like to say something here with reference to the many opinions or guesses that I have received or have read concerning the motives and meaning of the tale. The prime motive was the desire of a tale-teller to try his hand at a really long story that would hold the attention of readers, amuse them, delight them, and at times maybe excite them or deeply move them. As a guide, I had only my own feelings for what is appealing or moving, and for many the guide was inevitably often at fault. Some who have read the book, or at any rate have reviewed it, have found it boring, absurd, or contemptible, and I have no cause to complain, since I have similar opinions of their works, or of the kinds of writing that they evidently prefer. But even from the points of view of many who have enjoyed my story, there is much that fails to please. It is perhaps not possible in a long tale to please everybody at all points, nor to displease everybody at the same points. For I find from the letters that I have received that the passages or chapters that are to some a blemish are all by others specially approved. The most critical reader of all, myself, now finds many defects, minor and major, but being fortunately under no obligation either to review the book or to write it again, he will pass over these in silence, except one that has been noted by others: the book is too short. As for any inner meaning or message, it has in the intention of the author none. It is neither allegorical nor topical. As the story grew, it put down roots into the past and threw out unexpected branches. But its main theme was settled from the outset by the inevitable choice of the ring as the link between it and the hobbit. The crucial chapter, The Shadow of the Past, is one of the oldest parts of the tale. It was written long before the foreshadow of 1939 had yet become a threat of inevitable disaster, and from that point the story would have developed along essentially the same lines if that disaster had been averted. Its sources are things long before in mind, or in some cases already written, and little or nothing in it was modified by the war that began in 1939 or its sequels. The real war does not resemble the legendary war in its process or its conclusion. If it had inspired or directed the development of the legend, then certainly the ring would have been seized and used against Sauron. He would not have been annihilated but enslaved, and Barad-dûr would not have been destroyed but occupied. Saruman, failing to get possession of the ring, would in the confusion and treacheries of the time have found in Mordor the missing links in his own researches into ring lore, and before long he would have made a great ring of his own with which to challenge the self-styled ruler of Middle-earth. In that conflict, both sides would have held hobbits in hatred and contempt. They would not long have survived, even as slaves. Other arrangements could be devised according to the tastes or views of those who like allegory or topical reference. But I cordially dislike allegory in all its manifestations, and always have done so since I grew old and wary enough to detect its presence. I much prefer history, true or feigned, with its varied applicability to the thought and experience of readers. I think that many confuse applicability with allegory, but the one resides in the freedom of the reader and the other in the purposed domination of the author. An author cannot, of course, remain wholly unaffected by his experience, but the ways in which a story germ uses the soil of experience are extremely complex, and attempts to define the process are at best guesses from evidence that is inadequate and ambiguous. It is also false, though naturally attractive, when the lives of an author and critic have overlapped, to suppose that the movements of thought or the events of times common to both were necessarily the most powerful influences. One has indeed personally to come under the shadow of war to feel fully its oppression. But as the years go by, it seems now often forgotten that to be caught in youth by 1914 was no less hideous an experience than to be involved in 1939 and the following years. By 1918, all but one of my close friends were dead. Or to take a less grievous matter, it has been supposed by some that the scarring of the Shah reflects the situation in England at the time when I was finishing my tale. It does not. It is an essential part of the plot, foreseen from the outset, though in the event modified by the character of Saruman as developed in the story without, need I say, any allegorical significance or contemporary political reference whatsoever. It has indeed some basis in experience, though slender, for the economic situation was entirely different, and much further back. The country in which I lived in childhood was being shabbily destroyed before I was 10, in days when motor cars were rare objects. I had never seen one, and men were still building suburban railways. Recently I saw in a paper a picture of the last decrepitude of the once thriving corn mill beside its pool.